I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This one, on the forgotten immigration agenda, is a single far-flung story from China to New York's Chinatown, stopping in East Africa and Latin America. It's a single saga of a brokerage in human life that encompasses murder, money, every kind of corruption, but also sacrifice and suffering for desperate ideals. It's a story of refugees at war and in bed with wily cops. It begins in mass drownings and defeat, and it ends in long prison sentences. But the insistent theme music under all of it is the unconquerable drive that thousands, maybe millions of people feel to get to America. We're talking with the New Yorker's reporter at large, Patrick Keefe, who recounts this story in The Snakehead. Some are reading at a very high pitch, I got to say, Patrick. Snakehead means people trafficker in this context. Sister Ping, in her Chinatown variety shop, was the mother of all snakeheads. Patrick Keefe, there's a story here with many meanings and morals and personal mysteries, I must say, at the end. But I suppose you have to start with the story of Sister Ping and a sort of shipwreck off Long Island almost 20 years ago. It revealed the networks of traffickers and also cops, all surprised to sort of find themselves on that beach. What happened?
Well, on June 6th, 1993, just a few hours before dawn, two park police officers were doing a routine patrol along the coast of Rockaway in Queens, New York. So if you can imagine, it's a sort of a beach right there on the Atlantic, but in New York City. And they saw a mast light out in the distance, and they saw that a ship had run aground just a couple of hundred yards offshore. And as they looked closer, they saw that people were actually jumping off the ship and into the water, and the people couldn't all swim, and some of them were drowning. So these cops called for backup, and this huge rescue operation began, and you actually had hundreds of rescue personnel coming from all over the tri-state area to pluck people out of the water who were jumping off of this ship. One of the rescue workers who was there that day likened it to a plane crash on the high seas. And what they realized as they pulled these people ashore and tried to talk to them is that they were Chinese. They'd come from China. And that this ship was a smuggling ship with, ultimately, it was nearly 300 illegal immigrants from China who'd come all the way from Asia on a 17,000-mile journey. And the ship had eventually run aground. And actually, 10 of them died that morning trying to swim to shore. And as the authorities began looking into this, what they discovered is that there was a very sophisticated global trade run by these snakeheads, these Chinese human smugglers, who were really sort of immigration brokers. If you wanted to leave China and go somewhere else, to the United States or, for that matter, to Canada, Australia, Europe, Japan, you would go and see these people. And if you didn't have a passport and you didn't have a visa, that was no problem. They would charge you a fee and they could get you from point A to point B.
Patrick, it strikes me interesting that David Dinkins, then mayor of New York, actually hit on the ambiguities of this story right from the beginning when he saw these people. Their desperate effort to find freedom. And he said, I'd hope those people who are here already would recognize how important the freedom is that they have here. But then Sister Ping emerges as kind of the kingpin in a Chinatown we all sort of half know. Explain Sister Ping.
Well, Sister Ping was one of the snakeheads who it eventually turned out was behind this ship. And she's a fascinating woman. Her name is Cheng Chui Ping, and she grew up in China during an incredibly tumultuous period in Chinese history. She lived through the Great Leap Forward, the single greatest famine in human history, and the Cultural Revolution during a time of chaos, really, and sort of panic in China. And she eventually escaped to Hong Kong and from there to the United States. She arrived in New York in the early 1980s. She actually had a visa. She came legally, which is one of the ironies here. And she'd come from this tiny corner of China, Fujian Province, which is a little sliver of a province right across the strait from Taiwan in southeast China. And at that point, there weren't that many Fujianese in New York City. She was really one of the first in the early 80s. But she set up a little shop selling a kind of a variety of things. She made Fujianese food, and she had kind of common goods for the other Fujianese who were there in the neighborhood. And almost immediately, she started sending for people. And at first she sent for her immediate family and then her extended family and then people from her village and then people from surrounding villages. And she developed a network of international contacts really all over the world. And what they would do is basically ferry people, undocumented migrants, from Fujian province to New York City, often via 6, 7, 8 intermediary countries, sometimes by plane, sometimes by car, sometimes on foot, and then often eventually in the holds of ships like the Golden Venture. And in this way, she became a very wealthy woman and also a really respected and revered figure in the underworld in New York's Chinatown.
There's one migrant here, Sean Chen, in a very complicated story. That one guy, young man, sort of tells a great deal of it. Would you sketch him?
Right. Sean, I mean, in some ways is a bit of an everyman in that his experience was typical of many, many others. Just the sheer kind of scope of his story should give you a sense of the kinds of sacrifices people were willing to make in order to leave China and come to the U.S. When he was still a teenager, he made the mistake of crossing one of the party officials, the local Communist Party officials in his village, and he had to leave. It was made clear that life would be unpleasant for him if he stuck around. He didn't have a passport. He didn't have a visa. He didn't actually have any ID of any sort. And he was about 17 or 18 at that point, and he left home with just a backpack with a change of clothes in it. And his family made a small down payment to a snakehead, and he made his way to western China, to Kunming, on the border with Burma. He snuck across that border and then had to trek through the mountains of Burma, through the jungle, which at that point was controlled by warlords, and through the Golden Triangle, which at that point was really the center for global opiate production. So he had to sneak across these heroin fields, which took him over a month. He was stranded in the jungle for a time and eventually made it to Thailand and got a bus as far as Bangkok. When he got to Bangkok, there were snakeheads there who were supposed to put him on a plane, but there were so many Chinese at that point stuck in Bangkok trying to get to the United States that they couldn't find a space on a plane for him. So instead what they did was, after he'd been stuck in Bangkok in a safe house for about 6 months, they said, look, we can put you on a ship. It'll go to America, and it'll take about a month, but you'll get there. And Sean was a fairly adventurous sort, so he said, all right, I'll do it. But the ship they put him on was pretty subpar. It was sort of on its last legs. And it limped across the Indian Ocean as far as Kenya, at which point it broke down in Mombasa. Now, bear in mind, Sean had never left his village in China. And here he was with several hundred other Chinese without documents who found themselves in Mombasa, Kenya, stranded there. So he was there for about 6 months. And then a second ship, which was the Golden Venture, arrived in Mombasa, picked him up, which added up to about 300 passengers, in the hold of the ship, and made this journey. If you can just picture it, down around the east coast of Africa, it sort of rounded the Cape of Good Hope and then went up through the Atlantic, past Central America, and eventually ran aground in Queens. And the interesting thing is, you know, the voyage of the Golden Venture, it's hard to explain how difficult this was and the undertaking that it represented, but you had all these people in the hold. It was a 20 by 40 foot space. So really about the size of a 2 or 3 car garage. You had 300 people in that space. There weren't any windows. There wasn't enough food. There wasn't any place to bathe. They could go to the bathroom when they were lucky above board, but often they had to right there in the space where they were all living. And I tried to get a sense of how long it was that they were at sea. And I was thinking of – because I'm not a sailor and I don't really have much perspective on this. But I was thinking about famous historical voyages. And it turns out that the Mayflower – when it came to Plymouth Rock in 1620, was at sea for 60 days. Now, in 1993, the Golden Venture was at sea for 120 days. And Sean was in the hold of the ship. 4 months in this ship. And Sean eventually arrived with the other customers. And what the snakeheads told them was, if you can set foot on American soil, you can ask for asylum and the U.S. will let you stay. So even those of you who aren't able to swim, you should jump off and try and swim to shore, because that's the only way that you can be guaranteed that you'll be able to stay. And Sean could swim, so he jumped off. And the water was very, very cold. And there were people drowning around him on every side. But he eventually made it to shore and passed out on shore. And when he woke up after this long voyage and this just arduous experience, he was in a hospital. And there was a police officer there who told him that he was in New York City. And Sean looked around and he felt this enormous sense of relief. And then he realized this very strange thing. He was handcuffed to the bed. And so Sean and the other passengers from the Golden Venture who actually survived the journey actually were thrown into prison in the United States. And he ended up in prison for the next 3 years.
In York, Pennsylvania, as I remember.
That's right. So the passengers were farmed out all across the country, but most of them were brought to York, Pennsylvania, which is a town in central Pennsylvania, where there was a county jail that was willing to put up beds for these immigration detainees, and that was where they remained.
Cut to the chase. He's back in this country today. How did that happen, and what does it tell you?
Well, Sean eventually was released from prison, and he decided to stay.
But he was deported, was he not?
He was not. He was released from prison. He was paroled out by Bill Clinton, actually, in 1997, who paroled the remaining passengers who were still in jail. But I should say that you're quite right that many of the passengers who were ultimately deported, in fact, I found out in my research, about 100 of them who were deported, the vast majority of them got back to China, faced whatever punishment they faced back in China for having escaped, and then turned around and came back.
We're going to have to figure that out, how people go through hell, sent back to China, volunteer for the ride through hell again. I mean, to me, that's the great, great puzzle in this whole story. But there's so many strangers as we have to account for here, even in Sean's story, back in Fujian. You write about, I mean, one of the things that strikes me throughout the whole book is that all of this activity is illegal, of course, and it's prosecuted quite seriously, and yet governments promote it in a very pretty clear way. George H.W. Bush is considered among the Fujianese here in your story, along with Sister Ping, as their great hero. There's a passage midway in your book, Patrick, that sort of explains the complexities here and how the Fujianese in China pick up on the nuances of American policy long before we do. You write, word of the change in American policy, we're speaking of H.W. Bush era, spread to the smallest villages of rural Fujian. If you could set foot on American soil, even if you had phony documents or no documents at all, no matter how obvious it was that you had made the trip illegally, you were entitled to a hearing of your asylum claims. And if you uttered the words one child policy and rehearsed a tale of woe, a tale the snakeheads began coaching their passengers to commit to memory and recite on command, there was a good chance the Americans would let you stay. How do you account for this sort of American official collusion in a traffic we're trying to stamp out?
Right. This was one of the amazing ironies, and it's funny, it's an irony that I think the Fujianese community appreciated much before the rest of the country did, which is that immigration works in funny ways. I mean, it doesn't sort of map on to our partisan divides the way you would think. And Republicans who generally, I mean, for instance, in the immigration debate today, it's Republicans who are thought of as sort of tough on immigration. But in the context of China in the 1980s and 90s, the fact that China was a communist country and the fact that it had the one-child policy, which in some instances meant that women were obliged to have abortions if they'd had more than one child, meant that you actually had a very strong push among congressional Republicans to make all kinds of allowances for asylum seekers from China, because the thinking was, look, these people are fleeing a dangerous country and we should give them refuge here in the United States. And so after Tiananmen Square, George H.W. Bush had an executive order which essentially said, if you have people coming from China and they're either democracy protesters or they're fleeing the one-child policy, we should give enhanced consideration to their asylum claims. And the problem here is that that might be a great idea in principle, and it might be entirely defensible in the sense that we should allow people fleeing persecution to stay in the United States. But whatever your principled feeling about these issues, China and the sheer scope and population of China have a way of calling those into question. There's a great story, which I always thought was apocryphal but is actually true, about Jimmy Carter talking with Deng Xiaoping in the late 70s. And Carter was reprimanding Deng because at the time it was illegal for Chinese people to leave China. There was no right of exit. And Carter was essentially saying, look, this is a human right. You need to allow your population to leave if that's what they want to do. And Deng sort of scrutinized Carter and smiled a little bit and said, why, certainly, President Carter, how many million would you like? And I think that that's where we find ourselves on this issue with China. And that was very much what happened to the first Bush administration, is that they created this policy which was much more tolerant of Chinese asylum seekers. And word got back to the farthest villages in Fujian. And this huge boom tide began with people paying snakeheads to get them to the United States, because they thought, whatever sacrifices I have to make, if I can get there, they'll let me stay.
Patrick, for all the Chinese peculiarities of this story, there are many analogs of it elsewhere in the world, including Brazil, for example, or Africa, or Mexico. Would you just put the Chinese thing in context, or is it everywhere that's building their own networks, desperate to, you know, get over the barriers into Estados Unidos?
Yeah, I mean, you have an enormous population around the world of people who are migrant laborers, essentially. They are irregular migrants. They don't necessarily have the right documents. And we're talking tens of millions of people. Mm. I mean, I did some sort of back of the envelope math in the book. And, you know, it's basically a population larger than Canada's, dispersed around the world and on the move from poorer countries to richer ones. And the techniques used actually are very similar. And so in some ways, this is a very specific story about people leaving China and coming to the United States. But, you know, look, at the same time, even today, you have people from sub-Saharan Africa who cross the Sahara in a variety of different ways. Mm. And they want to get to Tripoli in the same way that the Chinese, like Sean Chen, wanted to get to Bangkok. Because if you can get to Tripoli, someone will put you on a boat and that boat will bring you to Lampedusa, an island off of Italy, and you might be able to stay. Similarly, if you can get to Morocco, somebody will put you on a boat and that'll take you to the Canary Islands, to Spain. We have these movements. I mean, you have people today arriving in Indonesia from Afghanistan, because if you can get to Indonesia, then you can go from there to Australia. So you have these huge currents, which no matter what the authorities do, I sometimes feel might just be undammable. I mean, it may be impossible to put a stop to that motivation and that market for leaving one country and getting to another. And the incredibly wily and often really ingenious immigration brokers who spring up to satisfy that need.
A man in Africa, a very sophisticated observer, said to me, in Ghana, blessed in so many ways, said that if you put a ship in the harbor at Accra and said, we're leaving tomorrow for America, people who get on this boat may go through generations of servitude and suffering, but they'll be in America in a few weeks. He said it would be filled immediately.
Yeah, it's extraordinary, isn't it? And I mean, the thing that was perhaps particular to the Chinese context, though I think probably not, is that there's a huge amount of acceptable risk entailed in these journeys. So in the Chinese context, you could actually put that boat in the water in Thailand, which is often where it was. People would have to get as far as Thailand. Or frankly, you could put it in the water right in the South China Sea and say, this boat is leaving for America. And then say, and there's a 92% chance that it'll get there safely. And there's an 8% chance that it will capsize or sink and that you'll die. You would nevertheless find a large number of people willing to get onto that ship. And this was, for me, one of the real conundrums of this book and this project, is that Sister Ping, this snakehead, who the government prosecuted and who the FBI, who I spent a lot of time interviewing for the book, really regards as kind of an international kingpin without parallel, the godfather of Chinatown, or the godmother, if you like, a fairly brutal figure who made a huge fortune. But in Chinatown, she's regarded as a saint. And similarly in China, I went back to Fujian province and did a lot of interviews throughout the province. And she's a famous figure and one who people think of as a fairly uncomplicated, good person, almost a Harriet Tubman figure for a generation of Chinese who basically she helped them create better lives in the United States. The sort of complexity for me is that some of her ships overturned. People died. You know, and in some instances, people owed her huge fees and she turned them over to gangsters. I mean, there was a story I tell in the book about somebody who couldn't pay the balance of the fee he owed her when he got to the United States. And he was held by gangsters at gunpoint and they called his family back in China and said, look, you'd better pay up or we're going to amputate his feet. Hmm. And so there's a brutality to this. But what I found again and again and again in my interviews is people said it's acceptable. We can deal with that. You sort of simple-minded American who was lucky enough to be born there, you underestimate the lengths that we're willing to go to. And so it may be that 10% of her passengers met an unpleasant demise. And it wasn't even that, but just say, for the sake of argument, that it was. They would say, nevertheless, she knew this is a risky business if you want to move migrants. And so it was worth it. And we forgive her, and we don't hold that against her as a kind of an ethical flaw. We just think that that's part of the cost of doing this business.
But now you're getting to the real nub of this question and why it's much more than just a detective story or a human trafficking story. This is a deep moral puzzle. I mean, Harriet Tubman did not make $40 million over 20
Indeed.
Years or whatever, as Sister Ping did. But I'm sure she lost people she cared about. Lives were lost in the Underground Railroad. But you're also getting to this question of who we're rooting for. I even wondered at the end who the cops are rooting for. But there are qualities of pioneer, indomitable determination to be American. Americans, as you suggest, they were Americans before they left Fujian in a certain way, and they remind us of the incredible ideals that this country wants to stand for and does in villages in Fujian. I wonder what your own head went through, Patrick, in terms of who the good guys were here and who the bad.
I mean, it was a constant process, and it continues to this day. I mean, Sister Ping is a complicated person, obviously, and I think that in some ways she's done a huge amount of good. But having said that, I don't have the I don't revere her or really agree with the kind of reverence that she's greeted with in Chinatown or China, in large part because she did charge so much. I mean, you know, the FBI is quick to say she's often compared to Robin Hood, and the FBI always says, you know, Robin Hood never made $40 million. And as someone else I talked to while I was doing my research remarked, you know, she made $40 million, but that was all tax-free, so that's $80 million to you and me. And I think that there was something fairly callous and a kind of life is cheap attitude that Sister Ping had. And so when she sort of paints herself as an altruist, which she does, I think she's been very successful in conveying that myth within the community, but I don't buy it. Having said that, she did have this interesting relationship with this gang, which in some ways was a kind of another turn of the screw for me in my efforts to understand this woman and this universe, where she, you know, when she started out, her business was very hands-on. It was very small-scale. It was a family operation. If you wanted to get from China to the United States, you know, she might get you you might get as far as Hong Kong, and then her sister would be in Hong Kong, and her sister would get you a visa to go to Guatemala, and you'd get on a plane to Guatemala, and when you arrived in Guatemala, Sister Ping would be there because she had flown there to meet you, and she would then personally hand you off to her brother, who would work with smugglers to get you up overland through Mexico. It was all very hands-on. But as her reputation grew and demand grew, she had to begin outsourcing. There were just too many customers. And at that point, she didn't sort of stick with a retail model, if you like. She started moving wholesale. And the people she brought in to help her were gangsters in Chinatown, a really violent Fujianese gang known as the Fuqing Gang. And this gang was led by a young, unscrupulous murderer named Ake, who was a young Fujianese guy. He'd come over himself. He'd been brought over by a snakehead when he was 14. I mean, to give you a sense of what an amazing character this guy is, he had a plane ticket that brought him to send him to South America. He had a visa to go to South America. But there was a layover at Los Angeles International Airport. And Ake was 14. He didn't have a visa to enter the U.S., and he didn't speak any English. And during this layover, he just slipped out of the airport all by himself and somehow found his way to New York City and joined this fledgling Fujianese gang. And he was a pretty flinty-eyed, nasty individual, very charismatic, very smart, but you know, he ended up killing five people. And when Sister Ping's business grew to a certain size and she needed help sending these ships to the United States, she turned to Ake. And to me, that would be sort of a strike against her in the ethical dimension, right? Because she's turning to this pretty unscrupulous, dangerous character and often turning her customers over to him and entrusting them to him. But the irony with Sister Panganake is that eventually he was arrested. And pretty much the first thing he said to the FBI when they brought him in was, "I want to cooperate. I can get you Sister Ping." And it took almost a decade, but eventually they tracked her down and there was this showdown. And this was when I first kind of entered this story myself, because it was when I started covering the story for The New Yorker. But there was a trial in the summer of 2005 where Sister Ping had finally been captured. And at that point, she was 60, a grandmother. And the star witness against her was Ake, this young murderer. And he pointed the finger and she was convicted and she was sentenced to 30 years. So pretty much the rest of her life. And after the trial, this murderer who she had hired and then who turned on her was quietly let go. And that, for me, is where the ethical calculus gets really complicated.
Well, this is where, for me, the morality of the whole prosecution just completely falls apart. This was a guy who said, I believe he said in the trial, but that he himself had brought in 1,000 illegal migrants.
Yes.
In addition to the murders, and yet he's the key witness against Sister Ping. I mean, where in the world is the right and wrong in this story at that point?
Yeah, I mean, this is something I struggled with, and it was a point where I really differed with the FBI guys and the law enforcement people who were some of my big sources for this book. It all depends on what you're aiming to do, right? In another life, I went to law school, and in law school, one thing you talk about a lot in criminal law is sort of what's the purpose of confining someone? Are you trying to prevent them from committing another crime? Are you trying to send a message? What is your aim? And I think in Sister Ping's case, they were trying to send a message. But I have to say, as an American citizen, I would probably feel safer if Sister Ping was on the streets and Ake was behind bars.
And then by the end of the story, one of the cops from the FBI, Bill McMurray, says to you that, of course, the law enforcement drive is going to fail in this thing because the trafficking business, he says, is too lucrative. And he adds, our country's laws are never going to get restrictive enough where you're going to completely stop it. Then he pauses. He says, which is probably a good thing as well. It's what this country is based on.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think for him, the trick is that he says this after spending the last decade chasing Sister Ping around the world. I mean, she really was his quarry, and this is the guy who just pursued her relentlessly and doggedly and eventually put her behind bars. But at the same time, a big part of his job is talking to these immigrants and going out there into the community and meeting the people who are her customers. And I think it's hard. I would imagine that it's hard for him, because I know it was hard for me, not to be kind of dumbstruck and inspired by the commitment that these people have to come here. And look, I think that the other thing, I mean, probably what he's getting at is that there's a peculiar bit of immigration policy in the United States, which is that if you get here, no matter how you got here, and you're illegal, and you have a child here, and that child is born on American soil, that child is a U.S. citizen, with everything that that entails. And I think that that's a big part of the lure. And it's something that I don't think is going to change. And so to some extent, when, you know, it's funny, Chuck Schumer now has taken the mantle in the immigration debate from Teddy Kennedy, and he's saying, well, we'll put the 12 million illegal immigrants living in the United States on a path to citizenship, but at the same time, we'll really kind of freeze the borders and stop future illegal immigrants from coming. I just think that's sort of cant. I mean, that's a bit naive. People will continue to come. And I think the reason they will is that we have this promise. And the promise is you can risk your life in order to get here. And when you get here, you can work like a dog around the clock. And that's what happens with the Fujianese generally, the undocumented Fujianese who get here. They're taking jobs that other Americans don't want, and they're working them around the clock for years for meager wages with very few protections and all the depredations of life as an illegal immigrant. But they know, and so many people have told me this over the past few years of research, they know that for their children, it'll be better. The kids will be born here. They'll be U.S. citizens. They can go to public schools. They can go to college. And eventually those children will join the American mainstream. And so I think that's what McMurray was getting at. And in some ways, for me, that's where – that's one aspect of the sort of mitigated morality of somebody like Sister Ping is that you know that in some level this is a kind of transgressive generation, right? Hundreds of thousands of people came illegally. She helped them get here. But it's just one generation. And eventually their children and their children's children will become assimilated mainstream legal Americans like you or me. I mean, there's a line that I kept coming back to actually from The Godfather, a wonderful moment where Vito Corleone, the Don, realizes that his son Michael is not going to be a senator or a governor. You know, he says, oh, I thought it would be Senator Corleone, Governor Corleone. He realizes he's going to join the family business. He's going to be a crook as well. And Michael says, we'll get there, Pop. We'll get there. And that to me is such a kind of perfect little expression of this notion of immigration being a generational thing in America, and that promise being that, look, you may need to break a few laws. And you may need to really, in effect, sacrifice your own life and your own happiness. But your kids might get there.
Mm. Patrick, the kernel of this story, it seems to me at the end, is that so many of the people who were convicted and forced back to China in the Golden Venture case came back to the States, most of them illegally. I mean, how do we account for that?
Right. It's extraordinary. I mean, I think part of it is that America – it's funny. You know, earlier I said that this was a universal story and you have all kinds of people going to all kinds of countries. But America does have a kind of exceptional quality in the minds, at least of the Fujianese. You know, even dating back to the 19th century when the Chinese came to America to work in the gold mines, this country was known as the Gold Mountain. And there was a kind of reverence for what it represented, the promise, the freedom, the opportunity. And you still hear in Fujian, people still refer to America as the Gold Mountain. There's still this sense, perhaps naive, that if you can just get here, you can make it. And what's amazing with the Golden Venture passengers is that, for instance, there were about 24 women on the ship. And at a certain point, it was sort of felt that if the women went back to China, they'd be punished for leaving. But if they stayed in America, they would have to stay in prison. And the Vatican actually intervened to try and relocate them. They were sort of between a rock and a hard place. And they found several Latin American countries through the archdiocese that were willing to welcome these women. And so there was this big kind of logistical challenge of, all right, well, we'll get them accepted in these other countries. We'll get them set up at through local church groups. People will take care of them, try and give them new lives in Venezuela, for instance. And 201, those women came back to America illegally. Similarly, the people who were deported would often be there just for a few weeks, just enough time to kind of cobble together enough money to pay another snakehead, and then they would undergo another arduous journey. There's a somewhat funny but also very sad story about one particular character who I write about, Wang Wudong, who was in jail in York and was deported back to China and turned around almost immediately and came back and made the same journey again all the way back. But the second time around, his boat was again stopped by authorities and he was captured. And the kind of bitter irony here is that the name of that boat that he arrived in, which ran aground on the Jersey Shore his second time around, was the Oops 2. But it is, I mean, all laughing aside, it's incredible what America represents to these people. And you know, the final illustration I'd give you of that, and the one that in some ways is most befuddling for me, is that in the 80s, Sister Ping had her network was bring people from Canada. People would get as far as Toronto, and then her family would put them on rubber rafts to raft over the Niagara River.
Mm.
And this was very perilous. I mean, one of the law enforcement officials who looked into this described these rafts as, I mean, these were not big rafts. It was that you could buy them in the store for $60. They're vinyl rafts. He described it as something you would use in your backyard swimming pool. And they sent people right through the dead of winter. And there's a story I tell in the book, a very tragic story about one of these rafts overturning in January and four people dying, including a little 7-year-old girl named Ha Wong. And reading that story, the thing that strikes me is, what's wrong with Canada? I mean, if you've made it all the way from China to Canada and Toronto, mind you, which actually is a big cosmopolitan city with a big Chinese population and indeed a Fujianese population, how is it that you would get on a little raft on the Niagara River in the dead of night in January just to make it to America? And that I continue to wrestle with, in large part, frankly, because had I not been born here, I don't think it's a risk I would take. I can't imagine taking it.
But I keep thinking about that. The moral challenge for those of us who got here the easy way, were born here, is, and it's throughout your book, is how many of us would go through these ordeals to be Americans? Are we missing something? And then there's that wonderful series of paintings that Myra Kalman did for the New York Times online, an extraordinary series about immigration. Nearly a million new Americans get here every year. But she raises this question about her own family, her own self. What is it about this place? And whose home is it? Whose home is it going to be? The torch of Miss Liberty in New York Harbor there, it wins at the end of your story. But it also raises questions about, are we missing something? Do even the super patriots among us underestimate something about this country and its allure? What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that the I think there's no question that there's a kind of magic out there. And to some extent, look, I think we blast it as propaganda. I mean, this is part of what's strange to me about the United States. And actually, if you go back to what we were talking about earlier, the Bush administration policy, this is kind of an example of it. But we want to be this beacon of liberty and opportunity. We boast about it. And I think we all, to some extent, congratulate ourselves for it. And then we're puzzled that we have 12 million illegal immigrants and more coming every year. Which seems rather bizarre to me. I mean, of course we do. For me, the really striking thing and the question, the sort of humbling and troubling question was, I kept wondering, what does it mean to be a citizen, really? Is it a piece of paper? I mean, what does it mean to be American? Is it a piece of paper? Is it that you own property here, that you pay taxes, that you fight for your country? You know, I wonder if there's not a way of thinking about it where, to some extent, we could almost think, you know, what kind of sacrifices did you make to be here? And this, for me, was the issue with the Golden Venture passengers, with people like Sean Chen. I mean, Sean is still not a legal immigrant in the United States. He's still not a permanent resident. He works as a bartender outside Philadelphia today. And he doesn't take planes anywhere because, you know, he'd rather drive across the country than have to be confronted by officials at airports who want to see his documents. And I think about what he's gone through. And it's something that I know, without a shadow of a doubt, I couldn't go through. And it does seem cruel and unusual and also kind of perverse that this guy who, to my mind, has earned it and is American is not allowed to be, doesn't have that piece of paper.
Patrick Keefe, it runs through your whole book that we have here, global conditions, vast global population, bigger than Canada, you say, that's sort of on the move and ready to storm the barriers. We have nothing like a global coordinated enforcement system to make any sense of rationalizing it. Are there any ways out of the paradoxes here, the moral contradictions? It seems to me the only long-term thing you can imagine is a development policy that would make life in Fujian province worth living. But what's the next step? Is there anything like a moral or human, much less policy, remedy here?
Well, I don't think there's a panacea, I'm afraid. I mean, I think you sort of need to deal with these policy issues piecemeal. And part of the problem is that everything you do, so many of the policy solutions here have perverse results. So just to give you two examples. I feel very strongly that the fact that we sort of have put our heads in the sand about the 12 million illegal immigrants who live in this country is naive and is cruel. And I think that we should put them on a path to citizenship. But I'm not naive enough to tell you that doing that won't then become a draw for further illegal immigrants to come to America. I mean, it's the exact same thing as in the first George Bush administration, that when you come up with these slightly more humane policies, they do act as a magnet, which can perversely compound the problem. Another example is, you know, you would think, oh, we don't want human smuggling, so how do we crack down on it? Well, we'll enforce the borders. We'll really toughen up the borders. But one thing I found in my research is that when you crack down on border enforcement, the snakehead business becomes much more lucrative.
Sure.
They love nothing more than a crackdown on the border. I mean, the analog there would be obviously the war on drugs. But when you criminalize it, then you actually – people have to turn to the experts in order to move something from point A to point B. It's actually much better for the snakeheads. They like that. So to some extent, we're playing into their hands. I think that the best thing we can do is figure out ways of allowing legal immigration and a really much more comprehensive asylum policy in order to very carefully determine what are these people fleeing? Should we allow them to be here? And essentially kind of trying to be a little more generous with the faucet, if you like. I mean, that's often the sort of metaphor you get on the legal side. And that's going to be one way of controlling the flow illegally. And it might be kind of politically difficult to do, but I think we have to, because otherwise we're just going to get these people coming through the back door, at which point we'll have the problem we have today with millions and millions of undocumented people kind of living in an alternative system within the country.
You haven't bit on my notion that somehow you've got to make life tolerable in sub-Saharan Africa and Fujian and Brazil and all these places that export the problem in a sense.
Well, I'll tell you why, though, and this is another of the paradoxes that I stumbled on in the book. During the period of time when you had – I mean, nobody knows exactly, but the CIA estimated roughly 100,000 people leaving Fujian province to come to America every year. That's throughout the 90s. The economy in Fujian province was growing 10% per annum. So it turns out that during the period of time when people were going to these amazing lengths to leave, Fujian was not the poorest part of China by any stretch. And it turns out that actually around the world, it's never the poorest areas that have a lot of out-migration. So what happened actually with Fujian is there were these economic reforms and the economy started improving. In the 80s, people were allowed to actually have private enterprise and some people started doing better than others. And that's what drives people to leave. Demographers call it relative deprivation. You know, if you've been living next to your neighbor in some humble village in the hinterlands and your families have been there for generations and everybody in the neighborhood has the same kind of stock in life, then people are going to be less inclined to leave. But in Fujian, what happened is some people started doing better than others and suddenly your neighbor has a refrigerator. Your neighbor has a car. Your neighbor has a television. And you don't. And you start thinking, well, how can I do better? And so you send a family member to America and they start sending back money. And at that point, you buy a bigger house. And then your neighbor looks at your big house and thinks, well, why don't I have a bigger house? And more people are driven to leave. So I'm not sure that just economic development in these regions would necessarily help the problem. And maybe this is another perverse instance in which, on some level, it might actually hurt if you've got – I mean, depending on how that economic development is distributed, if some people are doing better than others and the others are driven to leave.
Patrick Keefe, it's a better book, this Snakehead, for ending on not just on paradoxes but on a lot of moral mysteries here. I've thoroughly enjoyed the book and I thoroughly enjoyed this conversation.
Oh, thank you. Likewise.
Patrick Radden Keefe, thank you. Paul McCarthy edited this conversation with Patrick Radden Keefe around his book, The Snakehead. Our interns at Brown, Hannah Olson and Ben Mandelkern, helped us thinking this through. Please post your own notes on what this nation of immigrants means to us and requires of us in the heavy traffic of capital and goods and people in a global age. Post up at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for joining the conversation.